This is the 1895 podcast, official podcast of Shelburne FC, bringing you news, views and interviews from inside Tolka Park, Dublin's finest since 1895. Here's your host, Stephen Duty.
Welcome to the 1895 podcast, the official podcast of Shelburne Football Club, and we are brought to you by Go Loud. Go Loud is the home of Irish podcasting. As always, Ben Cleary is here, my work wife, my volunteer work wife, so the tax man doesn't get me. Hello, Ben.
Hello, Stephen. How are we?
Good, good, good. And we have a very special guest. We got requests for more player interviews. Everyone wants to hear from players. We had a very, very high bar set by Pearl Slattery earlier in the season. We've kept that bar equally as high with Shell's number one, Mr. Conor Kearns. Conor, welcome to the pod.
Thanks for having me. Thanks for the most pressurised introduction of all time as well, by the way. Nice one.
Everyone feels pressure at the start and then you keep chatting and it does be fine. Don't worry. We get there. We'll start with icebreakers because I just always find it mellows people out and people don't feel as kind of tetchy and nervous afterwards. But we've had a good chance to have a chat here while I was messing with the dial and trying to get things working. So, what is your... Excuse me, look, I'm about to go into the Darren Cleary chat again. Ben, I called you Darren before we start recording.
Yeah, that's gone not, into the chat with him. Not a good omen. I don't like this.
No, it's not great. Right, Conor, what's your favourite sport outside of football?
Snooker.
What is your favourite holiday destination?
Tenerife.
What is the best part of a fry?
Sausages.
This podcast nearly got shut down over that question.
Hash browns is the right answer there. I think I got that wrong.
I go for sausages myself. I think you answer it right there. Duty doesn't think hash browns belong in a fry.
No.
Oh, here we go.
It's not a fry. There isn't a hash brown.
Okay, that's okay.
That's fair. Yeah,
get it right.
Sorry.
The manager said something. He said bread.
A toast.
For this bit.
No. I wouldn't say bread.
Yeah, bread, best part of a fry. I don't know. Tea or coffee?
Coffee.
What's your coffee order?
Almond milk cappuccino with 4 shots of espresso.
Jeez, 4 shots of espresso?
Yeah.
One of them a day, I hope.
Oh, Jesus, no.
Oh, holy God.
I have a balanced out perfume, though, because I just crash at the end of the day, sleep for like 10 hours, and then I'm ready to rock again.
Who gave a really funny answer? Was it Mark Hoyle that said,
he came out with some mad coffee.
And he said he's long removed from Bart.
Yeah, the Finn Harps media fella actually listened to the interview and said that. He said, we don't serve them up in Bally Buffet. Right, Conor, I think it's important when we do these interviews with players that people kind of see past the jersey a little bit and there's more to you than just going out on a Friday or training during the week. So I want you to go right back. Where did you grow up and when did you start playing football or how did you get into football?
I grew up in Temple Oak and I didn't really show much of an interest in football in the early stages. Like, I wasn't one of the toddlers knocking around kicking a football. And then I suppose I was about four and a half, five, just after the 2002 World Cup. And I think I just got hooked on it. Went up, started playing at my local club, Temple Oak United. And it just transpired that throughout the years, we had a really successful schoolboy team from like under sevens right way up to about under 16s. So yeah, I just fell in love with it. And had a decent schoolboy career and wanted to carry on with it.
Any other notable bodies in the Temple Oak team?
In terms of like League of Ireland players, no, not many players kind of went on to have, I suppose, high profile League of Ireland careers. There's Conor Crowley would have played with me at UCD and played at Longford and Wexford. And then Stephen Kinsler went over to Everton. He was back at Patson Dundalk for a while. He was a hot prospect at that age. Just had a lot of injuries, was very unlucky. But no, there was bare bones after that of players who kind of kicked on. Very successful age group in and of itself, but that team, no, I think I'm probably the last one standing anyway.
Who else was your age group? Who would be the...
JJ and Boydie would have been my age. I would have played them.
Oh, they were Malahide.
Yeah, Malahide, which is a good Malahide team. I'd like to say Dan and Andrew would have played it. Trevor Clark, good few lads knocking around the League of Ireland.
That was Robbie McCourt as well, I think was in that.
Robbie McCourt was there, yeah. And then Queevy and Kelleher would have been the keeper and... Mark Travers would have played at our age as well up until about 15s or 16s. So yeah, there was a few very, very good players.
Must be weird for you now looking at it, like, you know, like some Mark Travers and stuff like that over in the Premier League. Like, did you come across them? Like, how well do you, like, did you play representative football or anything like that in PSL, or did you come across any of them lads other than just playing against them?
No, I would have just played against Mark for, like, from the time I was about 8 to the time I was about 15 or 16, so I was very familiar with him. But I know I was never really in like representative squads, or I was never going on trials or in international teams or anything. It was kind of, that's another sort of strange aspect of being the one player out of that Temple Oak team who's gone on to have, I suppose, myself and Conor Crowley, who's still knocking around the league. I was probably the one who wasn't capped or on trials or in DDSL squads. It was 9 or 10 internationals. So it's a weird one the way it's transpired that I'm kind of the last one still playing.
We had this crossover actually with Jack Moylan, that he was the same, never went on trial, never really felt like he got overlooked a little bit. And then obviously as it pans out, did you always think you'd end up as a professional footballer, even at that young kind of stage, as a standout?
I always thought I'd end up as a League of Ireland footballer. I grew up as a big fan of the League of Ireland, and one thing my dad, brother, mum drilled into me was the UCD pathway from the time I was about 11 or 12. It's like that was the route they wanted me to go down, and very quickly it was the route I wanted to go down. It's easy to say that now when you've done it, but it was always the focus for me was to go that way. And yeah, after that, it was a case of, well, we'll see what happens when you get into the league. And look, I'm very happy with how it's gone thus far anyway.
So that was your route in, was through UCD. What age did you go into UCD at?
I went in at, so there was no, like, there's 13s, 15s and 17s League of Ireland now.
That's what I was going to ask you, yeah. What?
None of that. It was 19s was the age group for me when I went in. So I went in at the under 19s. Myself and Paul Skinner's brother, actually Carl Skinner, were the two goalkeepers there. And then I just kind of, like, I played under 19s for a couple of years and got a bit of a lucky break with the first team, where it went through that transition of, they went to the totally scholarship program the year I was kind of coming into the first team. So they didn't have much choice in the goalkeeper department. So they kind of just said, we'll stick with him, kind of make me the project for the goalkeeper. And it just panned out quite well for myself anyway.
You've called that a lucky break, but there was obviously something there that they were happy to, well, I suppose you're saying with the scholarship thing, like UCD just in general, I think for people outside of it, it seems like a mad setup. Is it as simple as it's just lads there that go to college and play for the college? Is that it? Like when you were there, it was just strictly scholarship only.
Yeah, when I was there, that was the setup. And I don't know, like I said, when I said lucky break, I don't know if I was incredibly fortunate, but that team, lads who were in the college, you have Georgie Kelly, Liam Scales, Gary O'Neill, Greg Sloggett. So they made that transition, and it's hard to know if they felt like they hit the jackpot or if it's a model now. Like for me, like when I was there, it's like, have they hit the jackpot or is this the actual model now going forward? But they've had a couple of promotions and you know, stayed up the league 1 year and produced a lot of players. So it seems to be, I think on the other side of things, players now see it as a viable route into first team football. So it's a really, really good model that they have. And you can't argue with the results of player production in the last few years.
We've had that argument here about UCD. Is there, as far as you're concerned, is there a place for UCD in the Premier Division of the League of Ireland? A lot of people say, what's the point of being in the Premier Division? No supporters. They generally go straight back down. Is there any point? Where do you stand on that argument?
Well, from my perspective, I think it would have been, like, I know there's no supporters and I know it does take away from the atmosphere. And look, I know myself, I know some players and supporters dread going to a UCD away. But when you're a group of lads 18, 19 years of age and you work together for a whole year and you get yourself promoted, and you're definitely above Leinster Senior League level, and you want the option of going to education, and a lot of cases other League of Ireland clubs won't touch you, it's hard to argue against a team who goes in, comes together, wins a first division and gets themselves promoted. The players deserve to be there, and that's the bottom line, I think, really, when it comes to stuff like that.
You talk about your time at UCD and kind of coming through that pathway. What's the competition for places like?
It varies year to year, but I think the time I was there, it was serious competition. In the goalkeeper department was probably a unique one, because you had, first of all, a lot of young keepers were playing at the likes of Rovers 19s, and the kind of, it's such a unique position, an individualised position, that I suppose the cream of the crop at times were probably going to other League of Ireland clubs. But now I think I've seen it get stronger in that element. But in terms of the outfield positions, there was some serious depth and serious competition for places when I was there. I mean, players who weren't getting into the team went on to have decent careers, decent League of Ireland careers. So yeah, I think the more players that see it as a viable pathway, the more people you want to go there. And I know there's players who've been rejected for scholarships or basement told, look, this isn't going to happen because they're too stacked in some positions as it is, you know.
So then if you're looking to get back to UCD, like obviously Ronan Finn has gone back, he's probably the best example, are you kind of at the mercy of them needing a body in that position. Like, it, say if it was a goalkeeper, for example, say if it was you and you were trying to go back there, like, if they have two really, really good goalkeepers, will they turn a senior player away?
I'd say
if he's coming, if he's looking to come back, obviously get education and stuff like that as well, will they just turn him away and say, sorry?
Yeah, like, I don't know for an absolute fact, but I'd say if it was in a situation where, say, I was in, like, the position Finn is in, he's probably unique with the amount that he's won and the fact that he had a good relationship there from being at the club previously. But 10 years down the line, I decide I want to go back and do a Masters, and they've got two absolutely fantastic goalkeepers. They might say, well, look, we want to work on these lads, because where UCD will make money as well is like future sell-ons and stuff like that, the likes of, say, like a Liam Scales transfer. That's where they might be able to get a bit of income. So if they have two young goalkeepers who they could potentially sell on or let go to League of Ireland club with a clause there for themselves, they're not going to throw that away for the sake of having an experienced head for 1 or 2 years. I think they do a really, really good job actually there in terms of how they prioritise their players and how they balance that aspect of signing players.
Well, let's get back to you. Your League of Ireland debut came against
Shelburne.
Tell us about the game.
I think going into it, Shells and Galway were probably the two tipped to win the league at the time, because we were sort of, it's easy now looking at our team to say how good we were, but we were a bit of an unknown commodity. I know we went 1-0 down. Can't really remember who scored. It was probably Burbuck or Davy O'Sullivan. And second half, we just came out with a bit of belief and won the game 2-1. And I think that set us on our way then for the rest of that season.
You just went on to win it.
Yeah.
That year, didn't you? Yeah, because we ended up in the playoff, as we all know. There's people shuddering listening to this.
I'm kind of getting like...
Reece McIntyre, and who was Burbuck, wasn't it? Two red cards in the playoff final. So, you mentioned at the start there, when a group of lads of that kind of age come together, like, as you've explained it to me, it's way more against the odds than people realise, I think, when you've lads with little or no experience. You might have, what, max couple of years in the league. Some lads are literally in the door and next thing they're getting promoted. Did you think at that stage, right, oh, you might be able to do something out of this playing Premier Division football? Because you mentioned at the start, you seen yourself as a League of Ireland footballer, not as kind of anything further than that. Did that ever enter into your head that, geez, I might get a chance here to maybe go abroad or...
Well, the plan was to get into League of Ireland first and then see what that took me, see how I fared at that level and could I potentially get a move across the water then. So yeah, that first year I came in, I think there were certainly flaws in my game, but I was in a really, really good side that kind of started motoring and was high in confidence. So I definitely felt then that getting into a Premier Division team, the move I actually took after leaving UCD when I went to St. Pat's, I thought was written in the stars, absolutely perfect, nailed on 1 or 2 years there and then I'll end up progressing. And that wasn't how it went for me, but you know, that was a decision I made. I had the opportunity to go to England at that same time and I thought Premier Division football for a year or two was probably a better fit for me than academy football. So I had the belief, and look, I'd still like to think that I have the ability to get better and push myself to compete as high a level as I possibly can. You know, I think when you lose that spark and that hunger, well, then that's when maybe your performances start to dwindle a little bit. So, you know, I'll always hold on to that belief that I can perform at a very high level.
Is there any highlights that you have from your time at UCD? I know I have one that's sticking in the back of my mind. And I think Doody has the same one. So is there anything that just sticks out for you?
Oscar, there was one, and because when I was at UCD, the thing that people always bring up is the Bowles win in
that's the one.
When I was playing under 19s, I scored an overhead kick in the last minute, an equaliser, ended up on Soccer AM. It was a bit of
We actually, in research for this podcast, I came across that clip and I was like, hold on, I have to hear the story, Soccer AM.
Yeah, it was actually that happened. And we came back from Cork, I think the first team we were playing that evening then. And my phone actually died on the way home because I was getting so many messages and calls and all that. And I didn't realise how big it gotten. And then I had just sort of started training with the first team around that time. Niall Corbett and Conor O'Donnell were the two senior keepers. So I'd just done a few sessions. Ben's yawning here, so that's a bad sign for this podcast.
Yeah, I'm looking at him over there. But it's our weekend catching up on you. Go on, Conor, sorry.
But yeah, no, I got a phone call like 2 days later, and it was, did you just watch Soccer AM growing up? There was a fella called Rocket who used to be on it. Remember him? Yeah. Well, he rang me and it's like, it's Rocket from Soccer AM. And I was like, this is an absolute wind by the highest order. So I just told him to piss off and hung up the phone. And then like 2 minutes later, he rang me back. I was like, no, mate, it is me. Like, and it was an English number and all. So I was like, okay, grand. So I had to send over, basically just, they had to give me passport details. And the next week they flew me over. I was on the show. And the first thing I did when I got back was I went to Dicey's that night just to see
be a celebrity,
if anyone would recognize me. And a couple of people did, and I just got slaughtered by my mates for the whole night. Also,
yeah, I remember I looked at the clip earlier, and you had the crash pad out for doing your overhead kick, and you had the gloves on. Was that, did they make you wear the gloves, or was that just a choice?
Well, no, I was in goal after for the volleys and the penalties and all that, so they did like the volleys and stuff at the start, and I was in for that. And then there was actually, I wasn't really meant to do much on the show, but I think someone pulled out. I think it was JJ Okocha was meant to be on it, and he pulled out.
That's some substitution.
That would have been unreal. Yeah, I know. So I ended up doing like a small interview, and then they were like, right, we'll do the overhead kick. And
were you nervous doing it?
Absolutely bricking it, yeah. Because we did like a few like practice runs before the camera started rolling, and I missed, I think, 6 or 7 in a row. And then I was like, they had like 10 balls there. And I was like, if I miss the first one, I'm going to crumble. But yeah, and I scored the first one, and then, yeah.
Yeah, I remember it was really impressive that the first one went in. I was like, geez, fair play. First one in.
Absolutely shinned it as well. It was the worst contact I've ever had in a football. Your man didn't even try.
For anyone that doesn't know what we're talking about, you scored an overhead playing for, it was the 19s.
Against Cork, yeah.
Yeah. Scored a ridiculous overhead, and then the following week, obviously, Socrahan approached you, wanted to get you on because the video went a bit viral. But what point of the season was the overhead, the actual goal you scored, was that?
I was quite late in the season because it was like us and Cork. So the way it used to work was it'd be like, there'd be a league table, and then like the league would split into a league and a shield. You go to like quarterfinals, semifinals. Yeah. So we were coming to the last 5 or 6 games. I think we were top, and if Cork beat us, we were going to drop down to second. So that like kept us top of the table. We ended up topping it, and then I think we went on to lose the final or the semifinal that year then, yeah.
Speaking, you mentioned there that you went to Pats, probably didn't work out the way you wanted it to. You ended up with Galway. It's a big move. Like, it's a big, like, you mentioned you're from Temple Oak, so UCD, then your Pats, which is quite close by. Big life change, I'd say, for you, was it?
Massive, yeah. But it was that aspect of, like, it felt like the right fit, and I felt at the time in my career where I had to roll the dice and say, look, there was an element of it that it was probably, I wouldn't say like it was last chance saloon in terms of I could have kept plucking away if it didn't work out, but I knew I had a couple of fallbacks in terms of my degree and stuff like that. So I said, I'll go to Galway for maybe 2-3 years max, and if I don't feel like myself or the club are progressing in the way I wanted to, well, that could be me done in terms of with football. And my first year, I found it really, really tough. Just where I was living, I was living in a hostel with 10 different people. In a little box room, and I got overweight. I wasn't enjoying football, and it just gave me a big sort of reality check. And I said, look, dig in now and just do the best you can for the next 12-18 months. And look, lo and behold, I think nearly 12-13 months later, I got the phone call from Shelburne to make the move, and look, it paid off in the end.
Right, we'll jump into moving to Shells now. One thing I do want to ask you straight away, when you signed first, obviously Clarkey had gone the other way, mm-hmm. and Clarkey had been like Benatelli, really popular because he was a great goalkeeper, he'd done really good when he played here. Were you aware of that? Like, there was an awful lot of stuff about, oh, like, we've swapped Conor Cairns for Clarkey, what's going on, what are we doing? And I'm not trying to
put you down,
but that was kind of the way people were looking at it. Were you aware of that at the time?
Yeah, I think when I signed, I saw, to tell you the truth, I saw a few things on Twitter about people kind of, I wouldn't say having a meltdown, but weren't very happy that was the decision that was made. So I deleted Twitter. I think I learned the lesson from when I went into Pats. It was a similar thing. I was there to replace Clarkey. That's the impression I was under. And Clarkey obviously did very well, but I know myself, I probably crumbled under that pressure a little bit. I got too wrapped up in that side of things. So when I came into Shells, it was a case of, look, just do what you do, play your own game. And, you know, I had confidence I'd be good enough. And in this case, look, well, if you're good enough, then you're good enough. And that's it. Doesn't matter who you're replacing.
How does the move to Shells come about? We always ask everyone that we have here, was it a phone call out of blue? Did you have an inkling something was going to happen? How did the move come about?
No, I hadn't heard a tap. It was late in the season. And then Skinner rang me pretty much at the very end of the season. And I'd had one or two other options to make the move to Premier Division football. Ones that probably I didn't see as the right fit. I would have rather probably to stay at Galway. And Ken's rang me and said, what are you doing for next season? And it caught me totally off guard. I just didn't see it coming. And then similarly, you know, I was kind of hesitant. I didn't know if he wanted me as a number one or a number two or what the sort of plan was. And he says, all right, if the gaffer gives you a ring. So the gaffer rang me. I met him for a coffee and look, I think it was about 10 seconds into the conversation. I knew I wanted to come to Shells. And yeah, it just it was pretty smooth sailing after that then.
What happens in those conversations with the manager? Because we were lucky earlier, Ben interviewed Aidan O'Brien, new signing, and I had a little chat with him and he said the same thing. He's like, as soon as I sat down, within 5 minutes of the conversation with the manager, that was it. I was in, I was sold. What is it, just that intensity he has, that kind of passion he speaks with? Like, what was it that sold it so quickly for you?
I think just this infectious passion and honesty that he has. You can see he's really passionate about the project. He really believes in what he's doing, and he made me feel like I was definitely the right player at the right time to come into the club. So yeah, it's hard to fully describe. It's probably that X factor side of things where you just know it when you see it. And look, I sat down and he said, look, bang, 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 this is what I want, this is what you can do for me. He gave me a bit of stick over one or two games that I played kind of in a couple of weeks before that. No, it was not the playoff, but you can ask me about that in a minute. But he just said, you know, I'm signing you not for the Conor Kearns of Galway United, but for Conor Kearns that I think you can be for Shelburne. And that sort of stuff was exactly what I needed to hear, and it was really the right thing. And yeah, so he had me hooked pretty much straight away.
It must be great hearing stuff like that from someone, especially someone of his kind of calibre and his, like, how well respected he is. Because he came out and, like, he would be one for definitely protecting the players. Like, when you signed, he said, yeah, best keeper in the country. First few games, every post-match, it was best keeper in the country. He said the same, similarly with Mark Hoyle and JJ Lunny, best midfield in the league. People laughed at him. People probably looked at that when he said best keeper in the country and said, well, maybe not. How does it feel when you have that belief in you? Like, you must want to run through a brick wall.
Exactly that, yeah. I think what he said it to me in my first week of training, within like a day or two, like, he just pulled me and said, you have to be the best keeper in the country this year, because there's no reason why you shouldn't be and why you can't be. And the really important thing is, I believed him. You know, I didn't think, and that wasn't a case of like an arrogant thing for me. It was just, he said it with such brutal honesty and with such sort of like, I'm like, tell me I'm wrong sort of attitude, that I was like, no, I believe you and you're right. And this is like the chance he gave me as well to come into Shells, and I felt like I had to repay that to him as well. And to Skinner and Joey, obviously, who were more than welcoming when I first came in. So yeah, it's just that, like I said, it's setting a bar for me, believing in me, and make sure I believe in myself.
As a goalkeeper, you mentioned it's a specialised position. How important is the goalkeeper coach in a club to signing? Is that a deal breaker for you? Like you mentioned there, Skins rang you first, then obviously you spoke to the manager. Like, if you have a really good conversation with the manager, but then you have a conversation with the goalkeeper coach, you kind of maybe are a little bit apprehensive. Could that put you off a move? It obviously didn't in Skinner's case, but can it do in other clubs, do you think?
Yeah, it could. Yeah, I think the more experienced I am now, the more I've been around the league, and just around football in general, if I think there's a cowboy in there, or if I think there's someone who I'm not going to get on with, or someone who doesn't pull his weight, I just won't want to be a part of that setup. No matter, you know, what the prospects of the club might look like, I've learned more than ever as well that proper intense training as a goalkeeper, a proper goalkeeper coach, and a proper understanding of that like relationship that needs to exist is just absolutely vital for your own happiness first and foremost, but then your performance on the pitch. And look, Skinner gives that in abundance. So yeah.
Yeah, just on Skins there, it's a weird one, because like maybe he doesn't get the recognition he kind of deserves. He wouldn't be as out there as other people around the club. How important is he for Conor Kearns the person, as well as Conor Kearns the player? Because I know, speaking to young Dahi Folan through his injury, he's like, yeah, Skins has always been on to me. He's making sure, he's checking in. Is that massive for you?
Huge, yeah, because he knows more than anyone as well. The goalkeeper psychology side of things, you won't ever understand it unless you've been a goalkeeper. So Skins, in fairness to him, he just knows the right time, when to ring me, like he picks up on little things that might be bothering me, or if I'm not happy with something, he can kind of flag it, and he's always good at, you know, keeping me grounded, I think is the main thing. So I've had one or two moments or games this season where other times in my career, I might not got the arm around the shoulder or the kick up the arse that I needed, depending on the circumstance. I might not have had the reaction that I had. And like Skins, in fairness, not just the technical and tactical side of things, the psychological side of things, he's absolutely brilliant. And he has been for, I think, most every keeper I've spoken to that he's worked with.
We're talking there about goalkeepers. It's a specialist position. An awful lot of people kind of scoff at goalkeeping. It's like the old thing would be, yeah, he ended up in goal because he wasn't as good outfield and stuff like that. So I have a few kind of goalkeeper myths here that I want you to just throw your tuppence worth in on it, and just I'm interested to get an honest answer from an actual high level goalkeeper on some of these, right? So goalkeepers shouldn't be beaten at the front post. What do you say to that?
I think it's used too often and too easily. Like I shouldn't be beating at your near post. If it's a ridiculously narrow angle and it squirms in, you just shouldn't get beaten. It's not necessarily because it's your near post, it just shouldn't go past you. But I think it's an overused myth that just because it's slightly closer to that side of you, you want to cover the whole goal. You're like, so yeah, beating at your near post is an overused throwaway line, I think.
Goalkeepers that are glued to their line don't come out and claim crosses. Do you think does that just depend on the individual goalkeeper? Some keepers are just better at coming out claiming balls, or do you think every keeper should be out coming out relieving pressure?
I think there's a minimum standard you should get to, and you will hear things about goalkeepers glued to their line, and I think it's justified. So yeah, you'll see some goalkeepers who, you know, look, when I played, there was a time when I didn't like going for crosses, and the lads used to call me Dracula because I was terrified of crosses. that's the nature of the position. You have to learn it. You have to just grit your teeth and yeah, you'll make an arse of yourself sometimes, but yeah, you see it in keepers, and there is a minimum standard, I think, of come for crosses that you have to have as a keeper.
Penal shootout is a free hit for a goalkeeper.
No, absolutely not. No, I hate that line as well. Now, so I've even had keepers who say it to me, look, it's, you know, look at a draw. If you concede 5 penals, and the other keeper saves one, you feel absolutely horrific. And even think, like, you go back to like big ones like De Gea not saving 11 out of 11 penalties and then missing. I think Kepa did the same thing. That's not a free hit because everyone absolutely took the mickey out of them. So no, I think you'll always feel a sense of responsibility if you don't save them.
That line, some people come out with, nothing the keeper could do about it. Do you agree with that? Is there just some goals that you say, nothing you could do?
You'd say it for another keeper, but I think not for yourself. Any goal you concede, you'll always just feel like, and it'll be like it might not be like a permanently lasting thing, but for a day or two you'll think, I knew he was going to open up and go this way, or if I just gambled a little bit earlier. I was criticising myself for not saving the pen on Drogheda this year because of my approach for it, and your man put the ball in the stanch, but you'll always have that feeling of like, if I'd just done this, I would have saved it.
Right, last one, because I know Ben's giving me the idea, he wants to dive in with something.
No, I just wanted to dive in on that one actually.
Go on.
How hard is it, like, if you're in a game, you can see the goal, and maybe you feel like you could have done better, to just pick yourself up and, like, dust yourself off? Like, just psychology-wise, it must be very difficult.
Yeah, it is. It's really tough, yeah. Because you feel a real sense of responsibility. And I think this year more than ever, because I think last year I was so busy in games, in a lot of games anyway, compared to this season, that if you do concede a goal, a lot of times, I mean, like just dwelling on what happened for 30, 40 minutes before I have to save another shot. And if you make a mistake, yeah, it stings, but the thing I've learned is if you dwell on it, you're going to make another one, or you're going to do something daft, or you're going to go chasing something. So it's an experience thing. You have to make them to learn how to deal with them, and it's the harsh reality of being a goalkeeper.
My last one. All keepers are mad. True or false?
Yeah, I think so. In different ways, yeah. I think we all have a particularly dark side, yeah.
Is there any keeper you've worked with in particular that you just say, Jesus, he was off the wall?
Matty Connor, Galway.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah, and like dark horse, but if you know Matty, he's an absolute loose cannon of the highest order. Like, great crack, though. But I've even heard stories of keepers I haven't played with who I probably shouldn't name because I don't know them, that are just absolute bleeding lunatics. I've had a few nights out with like 4 or 5 keepers there, and they can get I wouldn't even say loose, just weird, like, you know, like not even like this is really funny, like horror stories to other people if you tell them, like, but
yeah. You brought it up earlier, I wasn't going to, so can bring it up. Galway, it was it the playoff game or
playoff final, well, the first division playoff final before you play the Premier team,
yeah? Yeah, so talk us through it, I suppose. It's probably the best way, like from your point of view.
I remember walking off the pitch and just being like, I just don't know what happened there. It was like there was holes in my gloves or something. I couldn't put my finger on it. I remember, I still say to like young lads, if they're having a rough session or having a great session, and say the best warm-up I ever had was before the playoff final. Didn't put a foot wrong. I pulled balls out of the top corner. I was zinging balls around for fun. Felt great. Went in, ready to rock. First shot of the game. It just kind of wobbled a bit. It shouldn't have gone in, but I should have known, look, that can happen. And yeah, I remember feeling really, really good. Like feeling like, right, I'm fine after that first goal, I'm grand. And then the second one went in and it wasn't great for that. And then I was just, Waterford actually didn't do a lot in the game. I think they only had 3 shots on target. We battered them for the whole game. And yeah, it just, before I knew it, the game was over. It's like I was in a bad dream. That sort of out-of-body feeling of just pure regret and just a proper sour taste in your mouth. But I had no time to dwell on it because I was closing that chapter of playing for Galway, as I'd find out very soon, and had to move on to a bigger and better things, I suppose, for me anyway.
Did it make it easier that you moved away from the club after that mistake, do you think? Would you have held on to it for longer if you stayed there and started the following season again?
I think it would have been tougher, yeah. Which, look, I was really, really close with the lads in the Galway dressing. It was a very unique sort of dressing room, that one. And we were a very, very close-knit group, and it would have been tough maybe coming in that next season, lingering in the back of your mind when you're playing in the first division, and no disrespect to it because I spent the majority of my career in the first division, but there's some games that can be really, really tough to play in. Lingering in the back of your mind going, this is a bit on me. But the thing about that season was it's probably the best season I'd had in football up until that point, throughout the course of the whole season. And I think I'd done really, really well up until that stage. And I had to take the positive and negative learning experiences out of it ultimately and just move on and do what was best for me.
That first season with us, it wasn't the, you know, we didn't have a flying start. Wasn't that the game we drew Drogheda? It was the first game of the season.
Nil
drew out. And Tolka, yeah. And then I think we were beaten by Pats after that then.
Yeah, 1-0.
We bet balls then eventually. But what's it like? And like Galway's a big club, there's no doubt about that, but there was a real buzz around Tolka when you signed. Like, we'd stayed up the year before, we'd gotten to the cup final. There was a real kind of, we might be able to go and have a crack at this now. What was your memory of that first game coming out against Drogheda? You're standing there in the tunnel, you walk out to the riverside. What's that first kind of experience like?
I was breaking it. Absolutely breaking it. I'm not going to, like, because still, as much as I've given it to talk about how, like, I had to focus on me and do what was best for me, I knew if I didn't, not even hit the ground running, but just be steady in that first game, those first couple of games, there would have been an element of panic stations. And I just, like, I would dread to think the thoughts of the Riverside if I had just dropped across on that first game and dropped that score, you know, like, it would have been everyone's worst fears confirmed, I think. So, yeah, I was nervous, but as I settled into the game, I was just, you could just feel this buzz and this energy and this excitement, and it really felt like the team, I kind of felt like from the word go, even after the loss to Pats, that the season was only going in one direction compared to the season before, and that was, I was up. And the target start of that season was to go and get European football, and you could just feel the energy in the players, and as we started to kind of climb our way up that table, the belief. And look, last season, whatever might happen in the next 2 or 3 seasons, I think last season will be a very, very special season for myself, and I'd imagine a few Shell supporters, as the season where real belief came back into the club, and for me, real belief came back into me as a player. Like,
yeah, you were talking about like when you signed and maybe the reaction wasn't what you expected. And
it was what I expected. It was just terrible. Yeah,
the reaction wasn't most positive, but people quickly, very, very quickly changed their tune. Like, how good was it seeing that side of it when it was like seeing the people really get behind you?
Yeah, well, I think first and foremost, I understood where Shell supporters were coming from. I didn't think it was a me against them sort of thing, because, you know, if any supporters, I've said it before, have a right to have a concern or just a worry that something isn't going to take the club in the right direction, it's Shell's, because there was a few very, very tough years for the club and a few questionable moves with players were probably made in years gone by. So I totally understood that aspect of things. And there were a lot of supporters who were with me from the word go, and you know, were very, very encouraging. So when that sort of dynamic shifted with the few who had their issue, I just kind of took it as I didn't take it with any sort of sour grapes. I just said, this is good. This is the club getting behind me. No one's kind of digging their heels in and saying it was still the wrong thing and being stubborn for the sake of it. And I had supporters last season come up to me and, weird enough, apologise to me as if like they had actually slated me to my face when they hadn't. They said I was wrong about you. And I was like, oh, cheers, thanks. It's great to know what you were saying before.
It's a real weird backhanded compliment, isn't it?
I was wrong. You're actually not terrible.
I actually played against a player last year, and I won't name him, but I don't get on with him. And he came up to me after a game and he said, after 10 games in the season, he goes, well done, yeah, it's great to see you playing well again. And I just kind of looked at him and was like, that's the most backhanded compliment you could give.
That's real catty. Yeah,
he knew what he was doing as well. And I was like, that's worse than anything.
The end just lingers.
Yeah.
So you were like, once you hear that, you're like,
I was real, real emphasis there. And I was like, and I had no comeback. I was like, yeah, you win. Fair enough.
Another thing that fascinates me, and I've done it to enough goalkeepers over the years. Take me to Tolka. Maybe we're not playing well, or maybe you've miscued a couple of kickouts or something like that, and you have a packed Ballybock end behind you, full of away fans. We'll go with balls just for the... What, like, do you hear that? The stick, the abuse, all that kind of stuff. Like, because as a keeper, obviously you can have a moment where you're not really involved, you're kind of stepping back. Like, can you hear it? Can you hear, like, the exact bits of stick coming out, or is it just a fog, or like what's that like?
I tell you, the worst team to play against, to have them in the Ballybock end, is Derry City, because Derry haven't travelled to Tolka in massive numbers, but there's always one loud, angry, naughty, middle-aged fella just nailing it from the word go. And that's worse than like an entire packed crowd of just white noise. Like, it's just, and I remember, I did something good against Derry. I think I made a save against Derry this year, and it was kind of like the Riverside was kind of clapping and all that, and I went like quiet, and one Derry fan just goes, you're still shite, Kearns. And that just sticks with you more than like loads of Bulls fans or Rovers fans or Pats fans getting out on you after a mistake, because you're like, that just feels personal at that stage. <That's the first.
laughs> You meant that.
So you can't register it when there's when it was like Zurich or when it was like Bows, it's just noise. But for whatever reason, when it's just that cluster of like 20 lads and there's one prominent voice, it's like they're in your ear the whole time.
I'd often think back to like the kind of mid-2010s when Shells were brutal, and like you're going to these poxy away games, like you're going down to, well, Drum and Salt Hill would have been a bit earlier than that, but I'd say some of those players didn't know what to do, because they're used to playing in front of hardly anyone, and next thing you have like 200 or 300 lads standing on a hill in the middle of Galway giving you stick. It fascinates me. But
I actually found it really tough as well. One of the hardest away games I had was playing against Shells for UCD in a 1-1 draw, and Gaz O'Reilly is a friend of mine, Shells fan, stood behind the goal for the entire half just talking to me, not even abusing me, just being like, how's your brother? And I was, as we go, I'm playing a match, like. And that was way more, and I felt bad for ignoring him. Yeah, I was playing a match, like.
You don't want to be rude, it's almost more unsettling, like, please stop asking me my family, my personal life.
But yeah.
I don't know how honest or how forward you can be with this, but that famous photo of you jogging up the steps in the Bowl, and the Bowl's fan is frothing at the mouth coming over the railings. What happened? What was the... Did you cause the big, I'm going to call it a schmozzle?
Schmozzle, I was waiting.
Did you cause the schmozzle, or were you just part of it, or what happened?
Yeah, entirely my fault, I'd say. I was getting stick off them all game, and I don't like them anyways, because they are who they are, like, you know what I mean? And we'd beaten them. I had absolutely shithoused, in fairness, for like the entire game, in terms of like time wasting and stuff like that. And I was getting slaughtered walking off the pitch, and I was like, you know what, you just have to savour a moment like this, because I know winning the derby is one thing, but there's a certain anger that'll be there after losing to UCD, and I was kind of aware of that. So I just, I didn't think it would kick off the way it did, to be fair. And like, you wouldn't want to know what was going on in my head when I saw an absolutely seething Detzer walking towards me with veins popping out of his head. I was like, I'm going to get murdered. This is the end. But I never seen your man chase me up the stairs. I actually didn't notice that at the time until someone told me afterwards, oh, you got chased up the stairs, and I saw the picture.
I love that photo.
But that's such gas. A picture, yeah. It's just, see, like, on my birthday and all, there's people like photoshopped their face on it and them carrying a birthday cake up the stairs. Not my brother did it, actually. Some of the things that were done with that picture are brilliant.
I'd stick it on the mantle.
It's a really, really good memory. Like, I know what happened afterwards with like the suspension and all that was sickening, but like, I can't regret it because it was the buzz afterwards and just a bit of crack that I have with, when I say crack, the bit of back and forth I've had with Bulls fans since then. Like, it's what you live for and that's what you play for. I wouldn't want to be an unknown, you know what I mean? I'd rather be a hate figure than an unknown. Like,
that was one of the selling points when you came to Chelsea. I was like, yeah, Bulls hate him. Great.
Yeah, it was a real positive. Yeah, definitely was. Yeah, yeah, absolutely. You mentioned there about after after all that happened and the buzz you have, how do you come down after a game? Because I know you hear lads that don't sleep a wink, they're up till all hours of the morning. What's your post-game like?
Similar. I wouldn't really sleep after a game. I'd be fairly wired, and especially like if it's a bad result, it's just so hard to switch off. And I know, like, I was kind of messing about it earlier, but I have so much caffeine intake on a match day as well. I'm absolutely wired. One of my coaches used to tell me, he's surprised I wasn't pissing electricity after games because of the amount of caffeine I used to have. But yeah, so I'd just be kind of bouncing off the walls. I'd usually go home, watch the game back straight away. Probably talk to one or two of the lads who were probably watching it at the same time, just chat about it. And then you're rocking for your recovery on Saturday. And by the time that Saturday session finishes, it's just a new week and a new game week, and it's rest and recover. Get yourself back on the horse.
Is it that quick, like that, just say, I don't know, I'm trying to think of a particularly like devastating result we've had. Say Galway away, mm-hmm. That was a pretty bad one. When you come in the following day, you just train, recover, do whatever you do. Is it really the next day, that's it, that's gone, is it that straightforward?
Yeah, it's not that easy to put it behind you, but I've kind of tried to settle on this 24 to 48 hour window where you, ideally 24, where you just kind of put it behind you, because especially if you look at this season, how thick and fast the games come, how quickly things move. Sometimes you need to unplug, you know, sometimes you need to see, like, you know, your girlfriend or your mates or whatever it might be, just to unplug from football altogether and put it behind you. But yeah, you have no time to dwell on things, no matter how much it stings. And the same goes for the end of the season. I think you see within a week of the season ending, the entire League of Ireland in the airport going away, because it's like, just whatever, good or bad, I need to just recharge the batteries and forget about football for a day or two.
At what point last year, you obviously can't speak for the group, but for you, at what point did you say to yourself, we could qualify for Europe here, we could definitely do it?
Genuinely day one. I know it's like, I'd never really doubted it from the word go. I had that, probably different to some players, that freshness of just coming in the door and having spoken with the manager, and I was on such a high in terms of the intensity of the training and how good things were that I was very, very confident from the off. And I think when we got our first, when we beat Bowles, which was actually early in the season, I really felt like, yeah, no, this is, we can definitely nail this and get over the line for European football. Obviously, it didn't come into our hands come the last day of the season, but a double of Bowles losing the cup final and us getting into Europe is a lot sweeter anyway, I think so.
You're telling me. Elliot is a very happy household.
That last game of the season, a bit of a mad one from everyone's perspective. I think I remember halftime, Darren turns to me and says, we're grand. Was there a bit of an issue with you coming into that game? Was there a sickness there?
So I tore my calf the day before the UCD game, and the prognosis was sort of, look, you're done for the season, you're not going to play. I was in a lot of pain with it. I couldn't really walk for a couple of days with it. It just really tightened up. And I think it came to the last day of the season, and the manager said to me, do you know what? Now we need you, and it's only one game. And it's, I know a few people might think, just to address the elephant in the room, I suppose, might think that Fiske had something to do with it. I think either way, that's what I was going to come down to, because once I got to the stage where I went onto the pitch and I was able to kind of move a little bit, he just felt like presence-wise and experience-wise, and he trusted me to get through the game regardless of what was happening. And look, the repercussions weren't going to put me out for next season, so I was more than happy to just strap myself up and play.
But that's, I suppose, kind of a bit of a nut up or a shut up moment, because you talk about, oh yeah, I'd run through a brick wall, I'd do anything, and then the moment comes where it's your chance to literally run through it, and you've done it.
Yeah, but listen, I wasn't the only one. Like, I think that was probably, I physically couldn't play that UCD game, and that probably brought up the questions of, like, you know, what's going on. So it had to be addressed that I had an injury, and that's why I was out. But I wasn't the only one. Like, Evan Caffrey had to get an operation at the end of the season because he played with a seriously bad ankle injury for the last 2 months, two or three months. So I wasn't the only one in that boat, but I think it just got to show what the players will do for the manager. Like you said, it's all well and good talking, but I wasn't the only one. A lot of players backed it up, going through the pain threshold towards the end of that season, and they probably need to do it again this season, but that's football. That's what you have to do.
Does that get frustrating where, like, you obviously, within the group, you'll know, like, Evan's carrying a bad injury, you're carrying a bad injury, but the general public don't know, and sometimes, like, we're probably guilty of being critical of a player's performance or something like that, but we don't actually know what's going on. As a group, does that get frustrating? Like, if you see stuff online about, geez, like, Conor Cairns can't kick the ball straight, but you had a torn calf. Like, does that affect you at all?
No, because I think when you get that nod of approval from the manager and the people who did know, and the players and the staff, it's like, you know, you're doing it for Evan, you're doing it for players and the supporters and the staff. But when the people who are there, which in the trenches every single day, when they give you that nod of, look, you came through for us. And look, I think all I did in that draw of the game was pick the ball out of the net twice, to be honest. We battered them. But the fact that I was there and a part of it and on the pitch and played and felt like I played my part just by being there, that's more than enough.
There was loads of noise after that draw of the game, because great result it was, and it was basically 50-50 whether we qualify for Europe. As you mentioned earlier, we were relying on Pats beating Bowes in the cup final. Our journey home from Drogheda was ruined by the post-match interviews with the manager. He obviously spoke to a few of the papers about the following year, and, you know, the owners and stuff were mentioned and all that type of stuff. Are you aware of what goes on, like, with Duffer, say? Because everyone's just all over him. Like, it doesn't matter what, he could talk about anything and he's in the paper for it. Are you aware of that noise around, like, there was talk he was going to leave? That's kind of the way it was put out there. Do you see that? Are you aware of it? And
I didn't know until that interview, when he kind of said if he was here next year.
Oh yeah, no, sorry, that's what I'm talking about, the follow from the interview. Like, do you read that and go, oh shit?
Oh, well, I saw that, because it was everywhere. Like, people were sending it to me and stuff. And yeah, when that came out afterwards, yeah, that's when I was like, and I wouldn't say we were in the dark, but, like, the manager's always really, really honest with us. And I think when it came to that point, he couldn't tell us because he didn't know himself what the situation was. I think we are, like, the one thing I say is people think he's big for sound bites and stuff like that. He says the same thing behind closed doors as he does on camera. Like, so you hear straight from his mouth, and then it might pop up in the media and it gets blown out of proportion. But that was obviously a big one. But yeah, he couldn't tell us much more than what he knew. And he wanted, and obviously he wanted to be at Shelburne, and we all wanted him to be there. So it worked out for the best in the end that he stayed, obviously.
Ben has a question he wants to ask you about managers.
Yeah, I had a phrase incorrectly. Duty helped me earlier. In terms of managers you've had, obviously the gaffer's very intense, he can be, but just your experience in Galway, that's another intense manager, we'll say. What was that like?
Toughened me up. There's no beating around the bush. He was incredibly driven, ruthless. Look, probably, I would say, I wouldn't say cross the line, but definitely push me to my limits and maybe a little bit beyond at times. Look, there was times I thought he was too harsh on me. That was his management style. The thing I say is, my opinion on him isn't gospel, because managerial personalities and player personalities, they don't always sync up exactly the way they should. I felt like I got to a stage in Galway where, not that I couldn't take anymore, but maybe I'd gotten everything I felt I was going to get out of that experience and that dressing room, and I probably wasn't going to progress much more. It was just going to lead to maybe just getting stuck in my ways a little bit. And that was a big part of feeling like I needed to move on, was that I loved Galway, absolutely adored it. And I'm very grateful for John for giving me the opportunity. He was really, really good to me. I didn't have a whole lot of clubs knocking on the door at that time. And he brought me in maybe as number one, but I don't think I could have sustained another year under the, just under the way it was when I was there.
Where did you watch the cup final?
In the Aviva.
You were at it, were you?
I was there, yeah.
Is that, what's that like, just trying not to jump up and down basically on Pat Scorr? Was it like that, or was it just
on Pat Scorr? Like, I was hanging out with Keith McDarby at the end of it. Like, yeah, it was unreal. No, a few lads couldn't go. They felt like they were too nervous. I just was so confident that Pats were going to win the game, and I wanted to be there to see it. So yeah, I went with who did I go with? I had a few drinks at the cup final as well, by the way. I don't know if I...
That's a loud season.
But I ended up in the box with McDarby, and good night was had.
I'd say it was.
You didn't watch it. You watched it with your family.
Well, I watched it,
you couldn't go to it because myself and Darren went. We were obviously all invited, but you couldn't stomach it.
There was a lot of that, and then there was a lot of... I had been to a lot of grim football matches with my dad, my brothers... So it felt right that we were probably together for that kind of moment. My poor mother's head was done in, because as soon as the final whistle went, we were on research in the countries we could be going to and all that kind of stuff. But yeah, I don't think I could have went to that.
You just knew it was going to happen after that one soundbite, didn't you?
Yeah, but I couldn't. Do you know what bit I couldn't have dealt with would have been if Bowles had won that cup final? I couldn't have.
Getting out of it?
I would have been done for GBH or something the way. There's no way.
My brother was going to go with me. Now my family are Rovers fans, which is pretty well known.
Yep.
And he was going to go to the game with me. And on the day of the game, he was like, I can't do it. And I was like, why? He's like, because I do want you to get Europe. But even if you get Europe, I have to watch Pats fans celebrating winning the cup. And that's just not a worthwhile trade-off. He's like, Pats winning the cup or Bowles winning the cup is like nightmare fuel. So he didn't go. So I think I actually went into the game on my own and then met up a few people there. But I was willing to roll the dice because I had a fair amount of confidence, like you said there.
Yeah. Oh, do we address that? He's gone now. He's dust.
Can I just say he was really nice fella. Really good man. Like,
do you know what? Everyone says that. Yeah. My brother met him through work as well and said, like, really, really sound chap. That's probably why he didn't fucking work for him there. But
when he said that, that's what I just don't know why. I just felt like it was going to...
Yeah. You just kind of knew when that was said, you're like, right, they're not going to do it.
I mean, my Twitter feed, I literally sat there and as soon as the full-time whistle went, I refreshed it and it was just all shelled people just with that video.
I chose to delete a story that night because I posted something and it got way too much traction way too quickly. But has ever seen Semi Pro?
Yes.
Yes.
And you know,
I was there when you posted this. I was standing beside you because you showed me the video. Yeah.
And I had Shelburne Can Celebrate All They Want and Jackie Moon jumping around going, fourth place. And I was like, nah, this isn't worth the backlash I might get. Within 2 minutes, it'd blown up. I was like, I'm just taking this down. I kind of regret taking it down, though, because it was hilarious.
I think the agreement was on the night, because, again, a few drinks was had, fairly hazy night, was you would post that if there was another tweet posted about our cups on sale in the club shop.
Oh, jeez.
Shelburne could bring that cup home.
Oh, yeah.
Think that did you hold up your end of the bargain?
Oh, yeah, that was trade off. That was posted.
Oh, that's on me. I bottled it, sorry.
Jeez, I didn't know any of this. So the cup thing was... I was learning. This is all the stuff I missed out on. Because there was a bit of back and forward on that night out, I believe.
Yeah, there was a little bit.
Yeah. He's not here to defend himself. So
we'll leave it.
We might talk about that one after. There's a thing with Shell's night out, and you obviously weren't here for the cup final defeat, but that ended interestingly as well. We'll talk about that when we finish recording next year. You can't hear that's a bit incriminating. Talk to us about your European experience this year. Well, was it what you thought it was going to be?
Yes and no. It is taxing. Like, it is. It's tough. It's an absolute whirlwind. Like, it just seems... I'm sure you felt it as well, because I know you've made the trips, and it just... Like, in and out of the airport is probably something you don't really think about, but it just felt like I was in Dublin Airport for a week straight at one point. But, yeah, that game away to St. Joseph's, although probably not a pretty watch... was just unbelievable experience, and it was probably the type of night we all wanted. Was just getting over the line, getting through the first round, unbelievable travel and support, and it's just left a taste and a hunger for more. The Zurich game, I think, was a learning curve. Probably came out of it feeling like once an opportunity missed, but next year if you come up against the same caliber of opposition, a bit more experience, a bit more know-how, and maybe just a little bit less nerves and tension. Probably took a lot of positives out of it, and yeah, it was a really, really good experience.
Yeah, we talked about this when we were over there. It must be really hard. Like, we obviously saw your itinerary, we had stuff to do during the day, but there's a lot of downtime for players. That must be very difficult to kind of manage, where it's just you're in the room, you're just waiting to do something.
It's strange, yeah. Like it's because most players will say it wouldn't even be superstition, but you just have a routine on a match day and something you tend to always sort of follow the same sort of timeline on a match day. I would anyway, and a lot of people I know would be similar. It's just it's what I do on a match day, and being put in a hotel room and having to kind of alter that. And that's the one thing I'd say is I'd probably not be concerned about minding myself too much just because I'm in a hotel. It would just be like, just do what you always do. But it's a weird sort of cocoon you find yourself in. And yeah, it has like those sort of minor unique challenges that I think people don't think about. But like I said, you learn from it, and you know, hopefully next season the club's back on a longer European experience and we can learn the lessons that we had to learn this year.
Yeah, I think in Gibraltar I don't think I've ever seen as many players out on walks. I mean, like,
yes,
like every time you walk down, it's like, all right, lads, yeah, just on a walk.
Just get out of the room, like, just get out and do something. Like, because there's this weird balance as well of being, like, a bit tired and a bit run down and having to conserve your energy, but also you can't stay in the room all day. You won't bloody sleep. You go mental. I was with Tyreek Wilson as well. Battered me an 8-ball pool every single day. So I needed to get away from him, would have killed him.
Yeah, the games was a bit of a funny one. Uno in the airport was a mad one. Like,
can I mention that I absolutely blitzed Uno and won, I think, nearly every single game?
Yeah,
I
was standing there recording the video of Uno and I was like, I'm actually just going to stop and just watch because it's actually really entertaining.
But you didn't post anything of me, actually, because I was in because the lads were playing in the airport and I went to get a coffee and it was a picture of every player but me. And my missus texted me and was like, are you just on your own? Because Shells haven't posted anything about you and they posted the whole team. And I was like, no.
Now, hold on.
Do you know the worst part of this?
Who was that?
Oh, well, no, that was Darren. He was in charge of all that stuff.
Yeah.
But the worst part is we were supposed to record a podcast. We were hoping to record a podcast with you in Gibraltar. And the day has just got away from us. I was like, shit, we're going to have to
I didn't realise, like, obviously I knew we were going to be busy over there. There's a lot to be done. But, like, we had brought, like, trivia card games to make videos. Like, we had loads of stuff for us to actually do there. We brought a mini football. We're going to do challenges. And then it's like, putting out fires all day.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Essentially,
it was
just
a bit weird.
I was never as happy as when you asked me to do the podcast. And I think in the evening, I was wrecked. And I was like, I'm just hoping I don't bump into Steve and Ben here. Like, they're lovely fellas, but like, I haven't got the energy for this today.
There was a bit of that. I think people kind of put their head down a little bit on, because it was Nagano and Tyreek we had something planned for as well. And I think they were the most relieved people in the world.
Yeah, they were going to do a little Mr. and Mrs. How well do you know your opposite fullback?
Yeah. And I remember bumping into Gano saying, Sean, I'm really sorry, we're not going to have time. I don't think he was too fussed, to be honest. I had a conversation with Luke Byrne after the Zurich game, and I'm saying, oh, geez, it's hard for players, like, isn't it, with all this downtime and there's a lot of moseying around. And straight away he bit back with, I loved it. I loved life in the hotel. I loved that, being away, full focus. Is that unique that somebody would love it that much?
Like, don't get me wrong, like, the experience of being there is class, and you feel, you do, like, it's proper, and another level of feeling like a proper pro, and it is really, really good. But I think, Luke, you might be the one who'll be that enthusiastic about it. It's a really good experience, it is, but he mastered, like I said, that management aspect of it and finding the balance. Whereas, you know, for me, I think next year, if I was to have that opportunity again, I could probably make a little bit more of it. But yeah, Luke is just wired differently to a lot of people in a lot of ways, in fairness.
But Luke was able to fill his time as well, differently than the players. Like, we've bumped into, was it him, Davy Mack?
Davy Mack, the most photogenic person in the world.
Oh yeah, you cannot get a bad photo of Dave McAllister. It's impossible.
It's like, was How I Met Your Mother, innit?
Like, like Barney.
Every time you snap him, he looks great.
Yeah, but we bumped into the three lads going off on the scooters. Remember that? Going out in the little... So it's easy to be so enthusiastic about hotel life when you're able to kind of...
We were getting texts like, nobody dare go on a scooter. Like, because there would have been a few lads, in fairness, Harry Wood for one, would have been zipping around on one of those things if he had the chance.
Stephen Doody was zipping around on one of them.
Yeah. Moving on.
It felt like... Do you remember Ben Foster used to make his videos? That's what the hotel life kind of felt like, where it was like, I'm living a Ben Foster video here.
We see them, they've all that experience, they know how to,
yeah,
they have it down to a T. Like,
yeah, like he was like, I have my Netflix, I have my yogurt and fruit, and I was like, ah, here, this fella's been around the block.
Yeah, I didn't realise how long the days are when you're away like that. Like, we actually had stuff to be doing in between and we had work to do, but like, does that make it more difficult to approach the game, that you're just sitting around constantly waiting for this big event to happen, particularly Zurich, because it was like big ground, they had a big crowd. Like, does it make it harder? Can you overthink in the build up to a game?
To be fair, I think it was more just the training session than it was the actual game. I think once, because I went onto the pitch in Gibraltar and we only trained it 2 days before, and I was like, I felt like I haven't touched the ball in weeks just because so much had happened and so little had happened in a weird way at the same time. So getting that session out of the way and before the day before the game is just the biggest dust off the cobweb session ever, because you're so, it just mentally switches you back on. So when the game comes around now, you're a little bit more in you're motoring a bit more then. But that first training session, well, my first one anyway, was grim. It was a grim watch. I think so. Did you try to record a bit of it and it was just balls flying in left, right and centre?
Yeah, I think I started recording and then I think the skin's turned to be like, come back in 5 minutes.
Yeah, it was just so bad. just goals but everywhere. Like,
I went over to record the rondos then, and people, like, they'd go to stop a ball and just go under their foot. I'm like, what is going on?
Yes, we hadn't played football in God knows how long.
That Zurich, people say all the time, like, there's different levels to football. That felt, even for us the day before, like, in the media centre, and it's, like, state-of-the-art stuff. And then we had to show them our media centre when they came to Tolke, and it was like the small bar maybe you could use if you want to do stuff. But like that moment, I know you would have walked out behind getting video and stuff, and you're waiting in that tunnel because that felt like, it felt like the whole ground was on top of you coming out in that tunnel. Was that kind of a bit of everything coming together? Was it like a feeling of this, what it was about?
Yeah,
all the hard work we've done.
It was nothing but positive. I didn't feel like, I think when the game started, there definitely was tensions and nerves, like, collectively. But walking out onto the pitch is like, yeah, this is what it's all about. This is what you want. And like I said, like, we've left with a real hunger for more, because the one thing is, probably didn't give the best account of ourselves over there. I think any player you'd ask would say the same thing. Obviously, incredibly tough opposition and like tough circumstances to play, but that feeling of walking out is not one that I want it to be a once-in-a-lifetime thing, you know. I want many, many more of them.
Something we noticed and we talked about after the game, it wasn't the reaction from the players that I thought. I thought it was going to be, now this is probably a victim of being in the first division for as long as we've been in it and not winning things and all the rest of it. I'm probably had the supporters hat a bit on, but the players were devastated. Like, it really felt like we had lost a cup final or a league decider or something like that. And it just, what, I don't know what I was expecting the players to react like, but that wasn't it. Was that because of the, you said there, maybe you didn't give the best account of yourselves? Was that the biggest frustration?
Yeah, like, there's no two ways about it. We got a bit of a hiding over there, over the 90 minutes. And I just don't think it's what anyone envisioned, and I don't think it's what anyone expected. And I think in hindsight, after the second game and looking back on the first game even, the gulf in quality between the two teams wasn't as big, I think, as we maybe let it be in that first game, and how it felt. I asked myself a few times if we got through the first 30 seconds without that happening, if we'd just kept it under wraps for a few minutes, might we have settled in? But it just hit us and everything hit the fan, and obviously we left with a feeling of regret. But sometimes feelings of regret and bottling those emotions can be what you need to just drive you on. I think you saw that in the second leg, and hopefully something you can see now in the next few games is, I don't want the feeling of regret like that for a long, long time. But football's like that. You're going to have days that sting, and they have to drive you on to do better next time around.
In a weird way, it would have been easier if we didn't play so well and draw 0-0 with them in the second leg, because there was a real feeling then of, geez, we might have been able to do something against these. Would it have been easier to maybe lose the game 2-0 and just say, right, look, they were way better than us over two legs, no real complaints? Did that second leg make it a bit tougher to take?
No, do you know what? I think, if anything, it gave us a bit more confidence of, like, look what happens if you back yourself just that little bit more and really gear up for the game in a slightly better manner than we did, not in terms of preparation, but just in terms of your mental approach. That second leg was obviously, it was disappointing that we went out, but people kind of looking around going, hang on a minute, you know, apply yourselves properly and just have that little bit more belief. And we definitely brought a bit more of a nasty element in the second game, just in terms of not showing them as much respect maybe. So like, in terms of, you can't regret it too much in terms of dwelling on it. So yeah, first leg stang a lot. Second leg, I feel like we righted a few wrongs and gave a better account of ourselves, and you want to use that to drive us on now. Like,
right, that's all the serious stuff out of the way. Ben, it's time. Get up the questions there. This is the most important bit of this whole podcast, right? This is your teammates.
Mm.
So
right.
I'll apply the same rules I applied for Pearl. I'm only taking one player. None of this, oh, well, it could be him, could be him. I'll give you two answers. One answer only.
Yeah.
You can't say yourself.
Okay.
Right, so you have to go with somebody else. Ben, do you want to go with the first one?
Right, quickest.
Cameron Levitch.
Slowest.
Ooh. Paddy Barra.
Most intelligent.
Lorcan Healy.
Yeah, I can see that. Yeah, to be fair. Makes sense with that article that came out about him recently as well.
You can't argue with the... He's got the stats, like, you know what I mean? Yeah,
true. Who was a liability on a night out?
John Martin.
John Martin?
That's a rogue.
Gives me more, like, older boy.
No.
Jesus, I won't throw him under the bus, but John Martin.
Bulgy in him comes out, does it?
It's not even close. It's not even close.
Tell you what, he's going to have to get the right to reply.
We got most vain.
Ooh, Matty Smith, but he's earned it.
Well, yeah, that's allowed.
Yeah,
I'd be vain if I looked like Matty Smith.
You literally took the words out of my mouth.
Yeah.
Who was the manager's pet? And you can't say Mark Coyle, because that's his job.
Ooh.
It's his job.
Who was the manager's? Paddy Barra.
Oh.
Well, we probably got a glimpse of that, actually. Yeah. That's
the... What did he say in the video? Yes, Gaffer. Okay, Gaffer. One of those.
Oh, yeah.
Thanks, Gaffer.
Jesus. That video was comedy gold. The launch in the goalkeeper jersey.
Yeah.
Because there was a far more intricate plan for that launch. And, right, we'll peel back the curtain a bit. The manager just took over.
Yeah.
He was like, right, let's go. Let's do something good. And that was it. They came out with that.
This.
Yeah.
We're happy with that one take. Done. Out the door.
It was perfect. That was just
to be fair. It was.
Angriest.
Mark Coyle.
I was expecting Cam straight away.
Cam's the easiest to wind up and lose his head, but if you're just talking about, like, I'm thinking on the pitch, anger, Coyle is the angriest on the pitch, I'd say.
Yeah, fair. Who's the funniest?
I find JJ quite funny.
Not a dark horse answer. Few people have said that.
Dry humour, no?
Yeah, but I like that. Yeah. To be fair, like, until he'd gone, I would have said Gav Malloy, which I don't think many people would have expected.
Jesus, no, definitely.
Yeah, Gav is absolutely hilarious, but people don't see it. I'll go JJ on that. JJ just comes out with one-liners that I think go under the radar and I find really funny.
Who's the best trainer?
I'd have to say Lorcs, because people don't see is that majority of my session is with the goalkeepers, and that's where the bulk of my work comes into. So, like, I'd say Lorcan and Healy, because keepers working so closely together, and I see how good he is. If you want me to give an answer like that, like, of an outfield player, I'd go JJ. I'm just recycling the same three players.
No, that's all right. That's allowed.
I know you said no two players, but, like, it's the keeper.
No, but I mean in one answer, you can't say, oh, well, Coyler or Cam are the angriest. It has to be just one. No, you're flying at this. You're flying it so far. A staff member you'd beat in a game of head tennis. We'll go with, like, player staff. So we'll say the manager, Joey, Skins, Davey Mack.
None. I lost to our physio in head tennis.
Oh, Lord. Connor, that's bad. That's pretty bad. Yeah.
We did doubles head tennis and I lost to our physio in Marrow. So
who was your partner?
That was Lorcan, actually, because it was his fault. I was going to say I'm not going to throw him under the bus. It was entirely his fault.
Goalkeeper Union.
This one's going to be a bit controversial. The worst trainer.
That's a hard one.
That's, yeah.
It's just because we're all terrible, not because we're all good. Worst trainer. This is a tough one. I'll go with Ray Tulloch fresh in the door, and because he nearly died in yesterday's session. That's the only reason why.
He got a bad one in Gibraltar, didn't he?
He took a ball somewhere. Yeah. He don't want to take a ball, basically.
I seen him after training yesterday and I was like, you're right. He's like, I didn't need this today. So that's why he just got absolutely run around.
Right, while we're on this, the Tuesday, it's obviously the most intense session of the week.
Mm-hmm.
How much of that are you a part of? Like, do you just do your own bit and then join at the end, or for that intense stuff, are you in there as keepers?
We're in, so if we go in to do like the individual defensive stuff, we're in it as keepers, or like say today if we're doing something like shooting or like crossing, finishing, they can be, they're so tough on keepers because you're just getting rep after rep. The extras are probably tougher on the lads, like the individual works, because it's a bit more of a blow for them. But the thing about the big thing with the Tuesdays is the standards that are demanded in them. It's particularly in the extras, if I'm in with Joey, like it's just constantly on you, making sure you're doing the right thing. So it is, it's tough sort of physically, but mentally as well, the how switched on you have to be. Like,
everyone mentions Joey. Everyone mentions Tuesday and Joey.
Yeah.
With Gav Malloy, I think Paddy Barrett, Tariq, Gano, everyone has mentioned him. Who do you not want to be stuck beside on the bus to Sligo?
Anyone. I hate sitting beside anyone on the bus. Like, I just want to be on my own. If I was to pick one player, I'd say Harry Wood, because he's just so giddy and wired and I just want to sleep. Man, I just want...
Yeah, we like, kind of saw that on the when we landed in Gibraltar. There was a bit of shoe hiding being done up that end of the plane.
You come back into the dressing room and either him or Evan Caffrey have just shoved food into your boots or something. Like, it's. I had a spare pair of boots I hadn't worn in ages and I had to wear them for a session, and it was like 2-week-old cake stuffed into the bottom of them. Like, the only time I've ever sat beside a player for an away trip was a Leinster Senior Cup game, and I sat beside Brian McManus and he spent the whole trip just farting the whole way down. And I was like, I'm never doing this again, ever. Like,
I'm not a bit surprised at Harry Wood. I was joking with him and I said, I seen him twice in Gibraltar. I seen him in Dublin Airport once, and I seen him in the airport in wherever that godforsaken place was we flew home from. And both times he was in the sweets aisle, weighing up the Harry Balls. Yeah, like, both times.
He spent 20 minutes eyeing up the Harry Balls.
Yeah.
Like, Harry is hilarious. I love him. But like, if you put me on a bus beside him for 2.5 hours or 3 hours to like Sligo, I think I'd headbutt him before we got half an hour into it. Like, it just asks you to, just comes out with mad stuff. Like,
yeah, Harry Wood's travel vlog, you featured in that, duty.
Yeah, Jesus Christ. Of all the people you could give him the camera to, in fairness.
He took it. No choice.
I want to know what Will Jarvis said when he said he was only messing as well, because you cut that out strategically, didn't you? I know you're not going to say, you can tell me after the podcast though.
I just don't know. I don't know what he said.
Can't remember. Oh, I haven't. I think I know. Yeah, we'll save that.
Come on, you're next.
This could be a little bit of a controversial one as well. Best dressed.
Ooh, that's tough. I'll go Ray Tulloch again. He's got a bit like.
I think you dress quite well. After.
Thank you. Got worse dressed about 15 times last year.
You did actually, yeah. No,
everyone just
the cup final last year. Now I thought you. I was like, "Jeez, you're looking sharp now."
I used to go home from training in my pajamas and stuff. Though I think that's why I got it. Like, honestly, I didn't care what I was wearing home. I was going home to lie down. Like,
who's the worst dressed?
Evan Caffrey. Oh, stinking fella has a Penny's tracksuit with The Rock, Brahma Bull on it. Like, it's just. Oh, once he brought that in, I was like, nah, there's no coming back.
The Rock track.
I'm going to say, at least Dev, actually, like, there's a few lads who won't be showering after training and going home in their gear. At least Dev gets a shower and changes, but he can do better. Like,
we actually, one of the weirder experiences, my time volunteering with Shells, the discussion around socks in, was that Gibraltar?
I think it was, yeah.
Boydie basically said, if a player wore Slazenger socks into the dressing room, he would just be told, live, you're not to be in here.
Or
is it that rootless?
If they didn't like him, they'd let him keep wearing them.
Yeah, true. Is it that rootless? Like, stuff like that. How tough a place is a dressing room for that kind of stuff?
It'd be just rough, depending on who you are. Like, you know, like people say Cam Leverage is easiest to wind up. Cam just gets it nonstop. Like, I'm just so glad I'm not over in that corner with him. Like, I'd be petrified.
Who's in that corner with him? Who suffers him?
Cam sits across from Boydie. And John O'Sullivan, and beside Matty and Coyler, and listen, he gives it back in fairness, but like when they pick their day, yeah, it can real come in.
I can see it. Go on, you're next, Ben. This is a new edition, actually.
This is harsh.
Yeah, I know. That's the point.
Worst haircut. Dodgy as Barnett.
Oh, sign out. It's Harry Wood. That's so easy. That's so easy. Like, I was worried for a second there, but
I couldn't believe that picture when he re-signed. I couldn't believe it.
It was the first thing I said to him when I saw him down in Talca. He was like, "You okay, mate?" I'm like, "What's wrong with your hair?"
To be fair, like when if I'd say he could pull it off if he had the right outfit and all that, but like when you see him in training, you're like, "Harry, just shave it, mate, please. I'm begging you. Get rid of it."
You have a penalty to save your life. Who do you want to take it?
Paddy
Barrett.
Yeah, fancy him. I think he fancies himself as well. Like to just, I just don't think it fazes him.
This one was very controversial when we answered this one.
Yeah.
Earlier in the year, who would win in a boxing tournament? We doing players and staff? Yeah. Because then you're opening up a whole different.
Yeah, throw the staff in. Throw the staff.
Throw the staff. I don't think any of the staff would win. I'd give Gaines a chance. Be surprised. I'd probably lean John Martin just because I think he has that big, thick, angry, culty side of him.
I said this to you. You could see him out in the field throwing hay bales around, punching the big thing in me.
Someone said Cameron Levitch. No,
that was you. Yeah,
I'll hope.
No, partly because like people just target Cam just to get him out.
Oh, that's
like Cam, big angry head on him, surely.
No, Cam would. I think Cam would go a decent distance as well. But
Cam and John Martin in the final. I'll tell you what.
Matty Smith maybe as well.
Someone said Matty Smith as well.
Yeah, I think Matty Control. I'd say Matty Control punch, all right.
Is that because of where he's from?
Yeah, I think.
So you're profiling these lads. Yeah. Profile Cam as well. Why is he so high in the pecking order?
So angry.
Everyone just says Cam's angry.
No, I'll change. I'll go Matty Smith. I'll give it to Matty.
I wasn't expecting that.
Mm. No, definitely not.
And the last of the teammates' questions. You have to have a team of five for a general knowledge table quiz. You're one person, so you can pick four others from the playing squad only. Who do you want your four people to be and why?
Coyler. Smart. Knows a bit, I think. Has a degree. Which is like...
I know a lot of people with degrees doesn't make them smart or useful in the table quiz.
He's got a bit like... I think he's come out with some good answers for... Like, Ward used to love a quiz question in the dressing room. Coyler came out with a few good answers. I go John. I know John does crosswords every morning. So
O'Sullivan or Martin?
Martin. I could be letting that lead me astray, but John likes a crossword. And
crossword in the
crossword. This like, just a he is the stereotypical farmer. Takes his break from punching cows and lifting hay bales to do a crossword sitting in the back of the trailer.
I kind of left it. I said, how rude this is the dressing room. Like the last month or so, it's mainly just been boys doing crosswords together. I've been like, here, someone help me here. What's seven across? I know.
We've crossed over into another dimension.
It's a ruthless place. People do crosswords and sometimes they don't help each other.
I go Lorcan Healy as well. Because again, I think Lorcan's intelligent. He's been about. And
you've two more.
Two more.
Yeah, Mark Hoyle,
John O'Sullivan.
Sorry, one more.
Yeah, I was like...
One more. John O'Sullivan, I think John's been about the block, you know. I think he'd have a bit
of street smart, maybe.
I just think he's...
He'd come out with a mad answer, I bet you.
He'd definitely have one.
And he'd say, I actually think it's...
He would, yeah. He'd have something like... But to be fair, I'd like to think I'd pulled away on that team. You've seen firsthand.
Firsthand, Silence of the Lambs, mad show. No one else had it.
Absolutely delighted myself.
Right, on that, this was supposed to be part of the podcast in Gibraltar. We obviously had to pull it off. Everyone says about you and movie trivia. Everyone.
I absolutely dug myself into a hole. Like, that was one good answer. I'm going to get like none right here. I'm going to look like an idiot.
Right, well, hang on. I have to find them first. Right, talk about something interesting, McConnor, there for a second.
Can you send them to me there so I can like...
send them to me with the answers,
not
please.
Not that type of podcast. What is your degree in?
So it's true social sciences. It's crime and social order is my actual degree.
So what day job are you going to get out of?
None. Absolutely nothing.
Why that degree?
I wanted to do law, and I wanted to go in to do a master's in law afterwards. So I started a master's in law, and then I left to go to Pats to go full time football. So the plan was to actually go on and do a degree in law, which I'd started, but Oh, it's just way too taxing to do two.
Yeah, would you have been enabled to do the master's degree and play? Like, that's a massive.
I'd started that and I started doing my master's and playing at the same time, and I just felt like both were suffering. Like, I was doing all right in the degree and I was doing all right in the football, but I just felt like I was burnt out. I was in 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. like non-stop. Sometimes I was into 10 or 11 in the library, like just trying to catch up. And I was like, look, I'm not going to, if I'm serious about giving football a go. And at that time, like I said, I'd been over to a club in England. They were showing interest. I heard that Pat's going to come in for me. And I was like, look, you got to pick one or the other now. So that's why I went to the decision to go to Pat's.
A master's degree, it's like, it's not easy. Like, you have to do your check-ins with your supervisor. Like, I'd say, like, working that around training must have been fairly difficult as well.
Oh, so tough. So, so tough. Now, they're really accommodating there, in fairness, obviously, because they know, because on the scholarship program. But look, since I've left, I've gone stuff in computer program, and I've like a couple of diplomas and stuff in that. Like, so I've kept myself busy in the education side, but I couldn't go back into a full-time master's now. It'd be a few years. I think, again, if I did that, it would be a case of when I'm settled and confident that this is what my career path in football is definitely going to be. And I don't think I'm actually fully there yet. So, look, plenty of time.
Duty, how are we looking here?
Yeah, I was thinking, I could see your eyes there trying to come up with another question while Steve looks up some trivia.
Come on here. You actually had all these prepared. That's the worst part.
Prepared. That is the worst part. It is here.
How hard is it?
I think I picked one of the questions.
How hard were they?
Some difficult ones.
If it's modern, I am in bits.
So there's a few modern ones. Duty picked some easy ones because he's not good at trivia.
I don't have a clue. We were sitting in the room and I was reading out the questions going, Ben, is this too hard? Is that too hard? And it was
there was some mad one, like, he was like, what is the baby called in The Hangover? And I just,
Ben or Carlos?
Right, Grant. No problem.
I wasn't expecting that.
Some mad question. Oh, no, this one is quite easy, actually.
Not at the table, Carlos.
Dude, has he saved himself here? Have you misplaced the questions?
I'm here. I've got them.
Right at the buzzer.
All right.
Jackie, look, Moon at the buzzer.
My last 2 days, we're an hour and 25 minutes at this. Never ceases to amaze me how quick these go by when you're chatting. Although when you're sitting in your hot seat, it probably doesn't seem.
Now it's just going to drag out now.
Right. What is the name of the fictional African country in the movie Black Panther?
Is it Wakanda?
Correct. What a start. You've already answered this one. What did Zach Galifianakis call the baby in The Hangover?
Carlos.
Or Ben. Which celebrity's face is the Michael Myers mask in Halloween a replica of?
Oh, that's a toughie.
Ben knew this one, yeah?
Yeah.
You knew this one, yeah?
I did.
It's from the 70s, that, isn't it?
78, I think, yeah.
Nah, not a clue. I'll go Steve McQueen.
William Shatner.
William Shatner.
Oh,
mask,
yeah.
White.
I did know that.
Found it in a hardware shop.
See, look. Pressure gets to everyone. Which Las Vegas hotel is the main target of Danny Ocean and his team in Ocean's 11?
Is it the Bellagio?
Correct. What is Andy Dufresne's first assignment when he gets to prison in The Shawshank Redemption?
I know he works in the library at one point. And I know he does the warden's books. And I know he does the cleaning. His first assignment. This is going to annoy me. I know there's a scene with the sisters where he's mopping up. Ah, is it the laundry?
Correct. Yeah. Prison laundry.
My God, that is working its way through that. That's good stuff.
Yeah. In Men in Black, Will Smith's character is known as Agent what?
Never seen Men in Black.
Agent J. That's one of the only ones I actually knew the answer to. Yeah.
J and K, isn't it?
Yeah.
Mm.
What's the name of Vito's youngest son in The Godfather?
Youngest. Michael?
Correct. What is the name of the main antagonist in Saw?
Jigsaw.
Correct. In The Terminator, which character is the Terminator sent to kill?
Oh, I've never seen The Terminator.
See, I find that mad that you could be so mad into films and not seeing The Terminator.
That sort of sci-fi stuff that doesn't do it for me, like Men in Black, Terminator, that sort of doesn't hook me in. Never seen Star Wars either.
Oh, neither have I.
Stuff doesn't hook me in. That.
It's Sarah Connor in The Terminator.
Correct.
Who is John Connor?
Yes.
Correct. Nice.
Terminator 3 then.
It's a team quiz now, is it?
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
I'm not getting out of no phone a friend. I've no like.
50. Yeah, no lifeline. No nothing. It's just, this is you.
Should have rang Harry Woods to get his answer and see how that went. Last one. In The Matrix, what colour are the two pills that Morpheus gives Neo to choose between?
Red and blue.
Correct.
He's done really well there.
Connor, that is an impressive return. Yeah. Very impressive.
I'm more. I'm happier with that. Didn't think it was going to go as well as it did. As
the hangover really got me.
Good over the Shatner one though. I actually knew that because I love horror. Love horror movies. Like
Halloween is my favorite horror movie of all time.
I wouldn't sleep after a horror movie.
Netflix documentary. Have you ever seen the show The Movies That Made Us on Netflix?
No.
It's incredible. You'd love it. Really, really good. Loads of great episodes.
There we go. Connor, thanks a million for giving up your evening. We do really appreciate you taking the time because you've come all the way into the city centre. So.
Oh, no, it's grand. I appreciate it. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you very much. Ben, thank you as always.
My pleasure. It's lovely. Lovely little chat.
And no emotional goodbyes this time with the Will Jarvis outro. We don't have to do anything like that this week, thank God.
That video rocked me as well, to be fair. I think I was sitting beside him when I went out as well.
Connor, thanks a million. Cheers, and we'll see you on Friday.
Thanks very much. Cheers.
Thanks for listening to the 1895 podcast, the official podcast of Shelburne FC, Dublin's finest since 1895. Don't forget to give us a 5-star rating on Apple or Spotify and subscribe now to never miss a new episode.